next week, next Tuesday, you have your exam tube at 8 in the morning in Hubble. You can use one side of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper as you did before. For exam period of time, you can use both sides. But for this, we still haven't got tons of equations, so there's really not a lot of need for it. I sent out an email with the material covered, so I hope you got that. I think I did that on Saturday. I haven't yet scheduled a Q&A session, but I'll try to schedule one either next Sunday or Monday at a time, so I hope that you can make it, or you can ask whatever you want. There is no problem set due this week, because basically, then I would have you doing stuff on problems that are, I don't want to cover on the exam, so I assume that most of you would think of that as a bit of a distraction, so I'm fine with that. We probably will have workshops next week, which will be on newer material. I haven't really decided that for sure, but I'm hesitant to skip the week of workshops just because you may have a workshop on Monday and I'll feel like going to get a test on Tuesday. So I'm probably going to schedule them anyway. And you can either go to workshop on Monday or you can go to a different section later in the week. But we'll see. I want to look at how far we're getting this week. I'm hesitant to skip a workshop week because I'm hoping that that's actually useful for most of you. And we are sort of moving fast, so even though we have an exam Tuesday, you don't want to really let the kind of stuff that we're doing since the end of the exam material go for very long. So, does anybody have any issues, questions about exam stuff they want to straighten out? Yes?
This is just about conservation of momentum. Is there any system where you don't have conservation of momentum? Or more just in the kind of theory of it, if you have something and you say throw it, it does eventually come to a stop. It doesn't keep going. So how does...
Right. Okay, so the question is, how do you reconcile the idea that conservation of momentum is always true and the reality of, you know, if you throw a ball, eventually it comes to a stop and things like that. Conservation of momentum is true within any isolated system. So when you throw the ball and you ignore air resistance, conservation of momentum holds true until it hits the ground, because when it hits the ground, you have some outside system that you break the system. So if you have something coming in from outside doing something, or it hits a wall or something like that, unless the wall is considered part of the system, you would then break conservation of momentum. I think you do have a problem where raindrops are hitting some sort of bucket bomb or something, and although they are coming to a stop and everything, in this particular problem, you do have momentum conservation, and you're actually using it to measure the force on the thing. So, when in doubt on the exam, it's always fair to ask, and you may or may not get a clarifying answer depending on specifically what you ask. But in general, it is my intent that you understand at least what I'm asking clearly, and I will always answer questions when I feel like I can. Okay? Anything else? All right. So we've been talking about rotational motion, and I think it starts out a little, I find it quite interesting actually. And the exciting stuff with rotation will come within the next week when we get angular momentum conservation and we start really looking at the dynamics of rotating things. It turns out that rotation is incredibly important, not just because wheels and CDs or whatever, but also if you do anything with sports, it turns out the rotational motion is really a critical part of almost every sport I know, so we'll be talking a whole lot about that kind of stuff. So it turns out to be really fun and very rich, as I hope you'll agree by the time we're done with it. But as with linear motion, it sort of starts off a little slow, but you have to have the basics. So I think angular motion, linear motion, is not as intuitive as linear motion, which is part of why I present things the way that I do. But I hope most of you are by now finding linear stuff fairly straightforward. And to do the angular stuff, there's really rotational analogs for everything that we've already done in linear motion. So we have the two general equations here and here, and the rotational analogs are here. And these are good regardless of what's going on with the acceleration. They come from basically the definition of the velocity, the definition of the acceleration. If you then assume that you have constant acceleration or constant alpha, then everything down from the line that I'm about to draw there works. Okay, that's weird. There's actually a line there already, it's just you can't see it. So it doesn't show up well. So I'll put another one there. Okay, so in the circumstances of constant alpha, you have rotational analogs, which you can use in the same way that you use the one-dimensional kinematics equations. And literally you can think of these as sort of one-dimensional equations, even though rotation is clearly sort of a two- or three-dimensional type of thing. Basically, within a plane of rotation about some axis with constant alpha, you can use these equations. And when you are using these equations, in the same sense that we did with the one-dimensional kinematics equations, in the 1D motion, we said something's going this way has a positive V and something's going that way has a negative V. In rotational motion, you define a direction of positive rotation, if you will, and then you would say positive angle, positive omega, positive alpha would be things that are causing you to either rotate that way, have increasing theta that way, have an omega, which is that way, with that orientation, and positive alpha would be increasing omega to go faster that way. The negative, having defined that, would be the other way. So it turns into a one-dimensional problem in the same way that you have one dimensions here. On top of that, we have the Newton's second law, F equals ma, linear equation, and we have the kinetic energy, 1/2 mv². And there are rotational analogs to those, where this, the torque is equal to I alpha, we'll talk about in a second, and we found in the class last time, kinetic energy basically has a rotational analog, which is 1/2 I omega², where I is the moment of inertia, alpha is the angular acceleration, and torque is what we mean when we say sort of an angular force. There are vector forms of these things. I'm going to sort of ignore that for a while. And during the while that we're ignoring it, you're going to basically be looking at something rotating, and you'll define one sense or the other sense as the positive type of rotation. Okay? And we're going to shortly get to where we define our vectors. But life's a little more complicated than we do it, but you can tell that we sort of have to have it, because you can imagine that something that's rotating like this is different from something that's rotating like that. So we have to be able to define the orientation of the rotation as well as the direction and the magnitude of the rotation. So we do end up having to put in vectors. But for now, we're sort of going to ignore it, and you can think of it as doing one-dimensional problems. So last time we talked a bit about this force equation. So the linear thing is F equals ma, and the angular piece is torque is equal to I alpha. And it's a little bit complicated, because what we found was when you want to cause something to rotate, when you want to give it an alpha, which is what you mean, you want to change its angular velocity. It could be from zero to something non-zero, or it could be from something non-zero to something faster, or whatever. It not only depends on the kind of force that you apply to the object, like you push a door, but it depends on where you apply it. So do you push it near the axis or do you push it at the end? And it will depend on the angle with which you're pushing it. Because if you push along a line of action that connects the point where you push it to the axis, nothing happens. And if you push perpendicular to it, then it acts to rotate the object. So it turns out that this force has a strange dependence. It actually depends on the distance. If this is the axis of rotation to this object, for example, you define the distance through which this force acts to be the distance from the axis to the line of action of this force that's perpendicular. It is the minimum distance from the axis to the line of action of the force. So we say line of action of the force is basically you take your force and you just extend it. For the rotational motion point of view, this force could be applied here, 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 here. It doesn't matter. So because it would have the same effect. The lever arm that matters in rotational motion is the distance from the axis of rotation. That's what's important. If I take this force and I put it directly through that axis, nothing happens. You can only rotate something if you have it a little bit separated from the axis of rotation. Note that I'm projecting out the perpendicular piece here. If you have that perpendicular projection of the force, or if the force is clearly operating at right angles to the line that joins the line of action to the axis of rotation, then the torque becomes very simple. And this turned out to be a pretty useful limit, so we'll use it a lot in the next day or two. But the torque then is very easy. It's just this distance times the force. And so that basically just quantifies, if I push it at the axis, nothing happens, and if I take the same force and I push it further and further away from the axis, I get more and more angular motion for it. If the door or whatever you're rotating has a lot of mass, it's hard to rotate. If the mass is distributed very far away from the axis, again, it's hard to rotate. And we quantified that rotational mass as the moment of inertia. And a way to think about it is if you have a single bit of mass at a certain distance r away, the moment of inertia of that bit of mass would be given by that mass times that perpendicular distance to the axis squared. So if it's further away, it's a bigger moment of inertia. If you have that mass and you put it right at the axis, there's no moment of inertia. It spins trivial. It doesn't. So to calculate moment of inertia, you would take all of the masses in this object and look at their perpendicular distances and basically make this sum of each little mass times that perpendicular distance squared, and you sum up over the whole thing. And sometimes you'll have discrete systems where that's exactly what you'll do. Sometimes you have a continuous system and you actually have to calculate this moment of inertia by going to the continuous limit. And you may have this mass changing as a function of wherever you are, the mass density may change, so you actually end up having to do an integral. So you can do a little practice with those. I'm not going to beat you up with those, but it is fair game for an exam or whatever. And you, if you really don't yet understand integrals in a sense, now's the opportunity to figure it out. And it will come back with the Gauss's law about 3 weeks into Physics 114. That is generally the point when most of you are going to be walking around shell-shocked like no other time in physics. And the real reason that you are is because you didn't figure out integrals now. So there is an opportunity I'd like you to really try to figure this out. I think I've promised you already, generally on exams I'll limit myself to about one or two problems that really take you to the continuous limit in Physics 113. I mean, it's not something I'm trying to define your grade with, okay? But it is something that is a part of the course, and you will have a problem on the exam that has something like this, so if you know how to do it, you're better off. But you won't blow the course if you're not getting that. But it might hurt you a little. So anyway, that's just it may take some effort to figure out the steam here. Okay.
Any questions about that? All right, so
much of the time, I'm really not going to ask you to calculate the moment of inertia for continuous object because some engineer has done it somewhere, you know. So there are tables of these things. In some problems, you'll just be given a moment of inertia and use it accordingly. In some problems, you'll have a particular shape that will be rotating about a particular axis. And if that's the case, and you're not actually given the moment of inertia, then you might have information concerning the shape, like the length, the radius, the whatever, the mass, okay? Then, very often, those are pretty conventional shapes. And if you actually look at all these shapes, you've got sort of a thick pipe, a thin cylindrical shell. You've got a solid cylinder about the center of the cylinder. You've got a solid cylinder about an axis going through the middle of this orientation instead of through the symmetry axis. A thin cylinder, same sort of thing, through the center, around and in, etc. So these things basically already calculated, and the form in which they give you are generally the moment of inertia is equal to 1/2 mr squared, 2/3 mr squared. They all have the same units. They all have this mass times meter squared unit. And if you are given a problem where you might be expected to go to a table and pick out one of these, you will generally be given, the problem will be written in such a way that you'll be given the mass and the length, or the mass and the radius, or whatever. Okay? Yes?
What is the difference between the two series?
These are, admittedly, probably none for your concern because you can't really read it very well and see it very well because it's pretty blurred out. This is a solid sphere about any diameter, and this is a spherical shell. So this one is empty on the inside because it's been... Well, any axis through the diameter is going to look basically just like this. That won't matter. It would matter if I took the spherical ball of shell and put the axis around one edge, right? Or through something in the middle that doesn't go through the center. Then it's a very different piece.
Okay, anything else? All right, so in general, for many of these problems, I'll either tell you what the mathematical form of the moment of inertia is, or I will give you the number, or I'll ask you to calculate it specifically. If I ask you to calculate it specifically, sadly, it probably won't be one of these shapes. So it will be something different. And I will promise you that if I ask you to calculate it, I will confine myself to one dimension. So we won't do something that requires a three-dimensional integral. All right, so given sort of what we've learned about rotational motion, let's look at this problem. Suppose that we have a wheel that basically is rolling without slipping along a flat line that then goes up sort of an inclined plane in such a way that there's no big bump or anything, so just sort of a smooth curve up here. And it's rolling without slipping. Starts with a velocity. The center of mass here is moving with velocity v. So the question is, what is the height, or how far up will this ramp, will the wheel go?
What do you think? How might you do this? If it were a small cube of ice moving on the floor, going up an inclined plane, how would you solve it? Okay, there's your first question you're going to know the answer to on the exam on Tuesday. No, I can't do that to you. So what would you use to do that? What do you think? Okay, so conservation of energy works. It's friction free, or there's, well, it rolls without slipping, so I can't say there's no friction. But what that really means, well, I guess we'll talk about it in a minute. But if you use conservation of energy, then I think one thing you might say is that the kinetic energy of the wheel, 1/2 mv², gets converted into gravitational potential energy. If we define H equals zero here, Y equals zero here and Y equals H there, then the full kinetic energy of the wheel is equal to mgh, which means that H is equal to v² / 2g. You okay with that? What's wrong with it? What do you think? Right. So when we say 1/2 mv² here, we are taking into account energy, but the only energy we're taking into account is the motion of this thing, linearly. In addition, it has this rotational degree of freedom that we have to consider. So this actually doesn't work. So a way to think about it is, if this wheel is moving without slipping, then you really look at it as you have the motion of the center of mass, and then you have, in addition, the motion about the center of mass. So this rotational degree of freedom. Because, remember, if I were to pin this wheel to the wall, and it had the same rotation, it has kinetic energy, because I have little pieces of mass right here which are moving some velocity that way. Little pieces of mass that are moving some velocity that way. Energy is a scalar, so that all adds together. So you know you have an energy in the rotation. So one way to think about it is to think of this whole thing rotating about the center of mass, and then the whole center of mass piece you just have moving. So we have the linear translational kinetic energy, which we know is 1/2 mv², and then added to that, we have the rotational energy about the center of mass, which is 1/2 × I(ω². Okay? Now, these two terms look very different, so in order to make some sense out of this, what I'd like to do is to translate this, because I'm sort of given the velocity to start with the problem. So what I'd like to do is to translate this into the linear variables, so that I can find this entire thing in terms of just the linear velocity, because that's what I start with. So I want to find how high it goes in terms of its linear velocity. So I know that omega is equal to the radius of this thing times b. No. I always have to start it like this. So omega is V over R. So this is 1/2 I(V/R². The moment of inertia also I'm not given, but let's suppose I have a radius, which I probably didn't tell you in the problem, but I specify. Assume it has a certain radius and it's a wheel. So in that case, if we go up here, a solid cylinder or disk about a central axis, although this is a very broad wheel, it's basically a wheel, is 1/2 mr² is the moment of inertia.
You'll get used to that one because you'll do lots of pulleys and things that will turn into wheels. I mean, they are wheels. So this is 1/2 times 1/2 mr squared times v squared over r squared. So the r's cancel out, which is why it wasn't actually given to you earlier, because in the end you don't need it. And that's one of the reasons why I try to tell you don't try to put in numbers, just because you like numbers better than symbols. In this kind of place, that can cause problems. So the thing you don't know goes away. And this whole thing is equal to 1/4 times mv squared. So that the total kinetic energy is equal to 3/4 mv squared. So now we go back to the same problem. Remember, we have this wheel going along and it goes up a distance h here. So we set the total kinetic energy, which we calculate to be 1/2 mv squared, if I didn't mess something up. So the total kinetic energy is equal to 3/4 mv squared, and that's equal to mgh. So you still use energy conservation, but now what you start with is different. So now h, the m's cancel, and h is equal to 3v squared over 4g. I'm a little bothered by this, actually, for a moment. I have a sneaky feeling I dropped something, but I'm not seeing what the problem is. At any rate, one of the things you'll notice is this is 3/4 v squared over g. This is 1/2 v squared over g. Which one's bigger? Right, this one's bigger, the 3/4. So the h is bigger than it is in the first case when we solved it without worrying about rotation. Why should that make sense to you? If I have this thing wheel spinning without slipping, it will go higher up this inclined plane than I would if I had the same wheel not spinning but just moving with the same velocity. Why? What do you think?
Because of the additional source of kinetic energy.
Yeah. I mean, the starting case, in the one case where it's just moving, you only have this translational energy. And that all gets translated into gravitational potential energy. In the other case, you have that energy, but in addition, you have this rotational energy. It is still energy. It may be hard to visualize in a sense, but you still have more energy in that system because it's moving and rotating. And all of that energy is translated into mgh, because when it's up at the top of its motion, if it moves without slipping, it stops rotating as well. So all the rotational energy and all the translational energy is converted into gravitational potential energy. So in the case where you have the rotation involved, you know that the height that it has to rise has to be higher. Okay? So you want to sort of think your way through these things a little bit to see if it makes
sense. Okay. So let's look at this for a moment. Note that the way that we're looking at the wheel's motion now is that we have translational motion with rotational motion around it. If you think of the wheel's motion in that way, you are thinking of rotation about that axis. And if you think of rotation about the axis of symmetry, then solid cylinder or disk about central axis, the moment of inertia goes is 1/2 mr squared. Okay? There's another way to think about it. Instead of thinking about the wheel as rotating with the center of mass moving and rotating about the center of mass, these really are independent degrees of freedom. If you've ever gone bowling, one of the things you can do is you can spin the ball and it moves, but those two degrees of freedom are largely independent. The ball can slide on the floor with or without spinning, or it can spin like crazy on the floor, right? Because it's constantly slipping. So the thing here that connects the linear motion with the rotational motion is this rolls without slipping. That turns out to be a really important statement. So when you say something is rolling without slipping, you really mean that at the very bottom of its motion, it's not moving. Because if it were moving, the bottom would be slipping. And you say, wait a minute. Dude, it's crazy. The wheel's clearly moving. Right? It is, but the surfaces are not actually moving with respect to one another along each other, right? The wheel is doing this as it goes. So the point of contact is changing. But those two surfaces, if I say it rolls without slipping, are not moving with respect to one another. It's like a car wheel if you don't floor it, right? If you floor it and you start to spin out, that's exactly what it means. You're rolling with slipping, right? But if you're not, then there's a direct connection between the motion of the car and the motion of the wheel rotating. Basically, that connection is that these two surfaces never slip with respect to one another, even though the wheel is clearly moving. Okay, so it's a little bit weird. So if you think of it instantly, at a moment, what's actually going on, a way to think about it is at that very instant, what you have is this wheel that is rotating about this point, because that point is not moving, and it has to rotate in such a way that this point, which is the center of mass, is literally moving with a linear velocity this way, because you know the center of mass has to move that way. And because of S is equal to R theta, and this is now you're twice as far away, so R is twice as far away. If you think of this as a big circle, for example, this is a piece of a huge thing that's rotating, this point being twice as far away will have to move with twice the linear velocity. So you can imagine that you have this wheel with an axis right here, and at that very moment, the wheel is rotating like that, about that axis, okay? Like so. Okay? You okay with that? Alright. What that means is that if you analyze it this way, then you are imagining that this thing at the moment is not translating. You're just looking at it rotating. But what's rotating is now a different sort of thing than what you had with the other point of view. In the other point of view, we thought of it translating with this object rotating, the wheel rotating. Now we have this wheel, and you think of it as just sort of rotating about that axis. Okay? And it's not moving, in a sense. Now you know that it is, so you think of this as just a snapshot. But let's see what happens. So in this case, we think of rotation only about the bottom point. In that case, the kinetic energy is equal to 1/2 I omega squared. Okay, I, in this case, is something we have to figure out. So what is that? And omega, well, we can figure out omega because you can think of a point which is a distance r. R is the radius. So this point is moving with a linear speed v. So you can think of this going through an angle, and it will move through some theta. Oh, let me not worry about that picture. You know the relationship between omega r and v. So v is equal to r omega. So omega is equal to v over r. So this piece is going to be v over r quantity squared. But what is I? So maybe you have in your table what I is, but I want to show you a way of getting it that's different. I don't think we have it in this table. So we're going to use something which is known as the parallel axis theorem. What it says is that if you have the same object and you have two parallel axes, and you ask, or you say, I have the moment of inertia about one of those axes, and I'd like to know what it is about the other axis, you can actually relate the two. So, in the parallel axis theorem, for example, if I have the moment of inertia through axis A, which we do for a wheel, it's 1/2 mr squared, we already did that. The parallel axis theorem says the moment of inertia about a parallel axis is going to be equal to the moment of inertia about A plus the total mass of this object times r squared, where little r is the distance between those axes. So it's a little bit basically like you're saying the moment of inertia of this thing is equal to its moment of inertia around the center of mass plus the moment of inertia wherever you think of the center of mass as being a single point rotating about this other axis. So it's sort of a combination of the two. So when you use the parallel axis theorem, we basically can take the physical situation we started with, which is where we have moment of inertia 1/2 mr squared. We know that if we take a wheel and we rotate about the center, it's easier to rotate than it is if you have an axis about one edge. Right? I hope that's intuitive for you. So we know that the moment of inertia of this thing spinning around this axis has to be greater. Remember, moment of inertia, really what you mean is how hard is it to make the thing rotate and get an alpha if you didn't have an alpha before. So we know the moment of inertia about this axis has to be bigger. Parallel axis theorem says it's like that. So if this distance is r, as it is in our case, because we're looking at the wheel now rotating about axis B, for example, and the distance between these is big r, we have 1/2 mr squared plus mr squared, which is 3/2 mr squared.
So that means when we view this thing as rotating about this point, and we think of its kinetic energy, the moment of inertia we put here now has to be the 3/2 mr squared. And you do the algebra now, you get 3/4 mv squared. Which is exactly the total kinetic energy we had looking at it the other way. You all right with that? So both ways work, and you may find sometimes you'll think of it one way, sometimes you'll think of it another way. And they both should give you the same answer. Okay. So let us suppose that we have lots of different shapes. The shapes are now rotating about the axis shown. And there's a certain symmetry in each case. So let's say that each mass is solid, and although it's a little hard to tell, let's say that they have uniform density. They have the same mass. Which of these objects is going to have the largest moment of inertia? For a given torque, which one is going to be the hardest to make rotate? I guess would be a way to think that out. So look at these. Fix the one in your mind that you think would be the hardest one to rotate. It would have the highest moment of inertia. Okay, close your eyes. You would, please. All those who think of A, B, C, D, E. Okay, so we had no hands went up for A that I saw, maybe I missed one. We had quite a few hands went up for B and C. A small number of hands went up for D and E. The answer is A. Tell me why. I mean, I'm telling you they have the same mass, they're solid, uniform density where you have something. Why is A the one that has the largest moment of inertia? Yes. So, the quiet comment up front here is all the density is on the outside. That's the thing. In each of these objects, if they're solid, they have a whole lot of mass that is very close to the axis. In this object, all the mass is distributed away from the axis. Now, it is true that you could argue, well, if this radius is really small somehow and these are really big, then. So maybe to be really super clear, I could put some sort of measure of radius around it. But this kind of qualitative question, one, you may see it on exams for me, you may see it on MCATs or other things you may take, but try not to make it super hard. This question is really trying to get at the mass distribution. So in a sense, you should develop, think about what the moment of inertia is. So it's not just the amount of mass, but it is amount of mass basically weighted by its distance from the axis squared. So it's not even a small effect, because it's the square, so it's a big deal. So in fact, the moment of inertia of this is going to be significantly bigger than the moment of inertia of these other things.
Okay? All right. So, just so you're sure, gravity works here. If I were to take this wheel and I drop it, it's going to fall like everything. But I'm going to roll it up. It has, it's a heavy wheel, which means it has a large moment of inertia. And it is connected to two strings. And look what happens if I let it go. You played with yo-yos before, so this isn't new. If you haven't played with yo-yos before, my assignment is to get a yo-yo, get two shots of espresso or two shots of tequila, whichever you prefer, this evening, after you, well, maybe not after. If it's espresso, do it early in the day. If it's tequila, late in the day. And play with the yo-yo a while. But one of the things you'll notice with the yo-yo is when you have it spun up and it goes down, it doesn't fall at a normal speed. So, why? Okay, so Thursday I want you each to do a shot of tequila or a shot of espresso before you come to class. And then we'll see if we can get some of you thinking. So why does it not just fall?
It's got strings.
Okay.
Why is it going slower?
This motion, I lift it up, same height roughly, okay, I drop it. What is happening just before it hits the floor here? Physically, it has potential energy here, MGH. That turns into translational kinetic energy by the time it gets to the bottom here. Then it hits the floor and all bets are off or whatever. Okay, but just before it hits the floor, you can sort of say all of its potential energy is converted into kinetic energy here. Okay? So next time you see a yo-yo, what you want to think is, okay, it starts with a certain amount of potential energy here. Okay? Then, as it falls, that is converted both into linear translational kinetic energy and the energy of rotation. Right? The heavier the wheel, or the bigger its moment of inertia, the bigger this kind of effect is. Because basically it takes a lot of energy to get it spinning. Right? I grew up in the South, so we say it takes a crack load of energy to get it spinning. Right? Man, is there a good movie on last night? You guys look dead today.
Alright. I mean, I know the material's exciting, so it can't be that. Alright.
So, now what I'd like to do would be these Newton's law problems, like you've seen before, but now what I want to do is to add mass to the pulley. Okay, so now it's just like what you've done in the past, except now you have this additional degree of freedom that you now have to worry about, which is this stupid pulley also has to rotate. Okay? It just gets more and more fun, doesn't it? I saw a couple of pained expressions in the audience. So, here's a standard problem. So we have two masses now. You've actually done this problem where we said at the start that we have a massless frictionless pulley. In this case, we will say that the pulley's rotation is frictionless, but that this rope moves without slipping. So there is friction in the problem in the sense that it keeps the rope from slipping, but if you want to think about it,
If there's friction and the rope doesn't slip, there is no work done. So that means there's no loss of energy to that. So in a sense, when you say that the rope moves without slipping, what it's really telling you is that you have tied together the linear degree of motion with how this thing rotates. Because the rope goes without slipping, if I'm going to pull a little bit of rope off the wheel has to rotate a little bit. Right? Okay, so the rope pulley, the pulley has mass. I give you a mass, I give you a radius of the pulley, I give you the mass of the two objects. We start a certain height up above the ground. The initial mass here is sitting on the ground. And then we let the thing go and we say the rope is massless and does not slip. It actually becomes a very hard problem if the rope has mass, because as you can imagine, you have a lot of rope over here, it has a lot of mass. As this rotates down, and we then have a changing and growing mass over here, so it starts to be a massy problem. So you'll generally always have this. And it does not slip, really is the key word that tells you that the linear and the rotational degrees of freedom are tied together. So now the problem is I release this system, given what it is, and it's going to rotate with this sense. And you know that because this mass is significantly heavier than this mass. And so the question is, what is the speed of this mass when it hits the ground? Okay? And now you've got lots of tools, so there are two ways of solving this problem. One takes advantage of energy conservation, the other would be Newton's laws, sort of using it to free body diagrams and kinematic equations. So we're going to do it both ways. And I can't even, you know, as a general rule, if you think it's fair to use energy conservation, often that's easier, so I would say it's certainly worth trying. Sometimes it's not so obvious. So it isn't clear to me that some problems might not be set up so that the other way is actually easier. So you sort of have to face each problem as you get to it. But if you think you might be able to use energy conservation, it's often worth trying. So to use energy conservation, we basically look at the energy that the system has to begin with, and we see where it goes as things change in the problem until we get to the very end of the problem. And in the end of the problem, what we're really after is how fast is that mass in the tube going in the very instant before it hits the ground. And I have definitely given a problem like this and had somebody say zero because it's sitting on the ground. Right? But, okay, true, that's where it ends up, but that's not really the problem. So the problem is how fast is it going just before it hits the ground. So the starting energy, it's not moving. The only source of energy you have is not rotating. There's no translation. The only source of energy you have to begin with is this gravitational potential energy of M2, which we say is 2.5 meters above the floor. So the starting energy is M2gh. Then, if this thing now is going like this, just before it hits the ground, I have mass 2 falling toward the ground with a kinetic energy. I have mass 1 rising with a kinetic energy. Mass 2's potential energy has dropped to 0 if it now is at the floor, but mass 1 has gained actually mgh, where h is 2.5 meters of potential energy because it's been rising. So we have kinetic energy of this thing, kinetic energy of that thing. The potential energy of this one has changed. This one has dropped to 0. And this thing is rotating. So we have rotational kinetic energy as well. So we have to then sort of say this amount of energy, M2gh, goes into all these other things. M1 times gh is the potential energy of this thing as it's risen. And the h's are the same because the rope doesn't stretch. So if this side goes down H, the other side goes up H. So I know this. So this is M1GH. Then I have a term which is the kinetic energy of this mass as it's moving up at the very end point of its motion. I have the kinetic energy of M2 just before it hits the floor. Again, these two velocities have to be the same because otherwise the rope is stretching. If this one goes down an inch, this one moves up an inch. If this one goes down an inch in a second, this one goes up an inch in a second. So the velocities have to be the same. So V1 is equal to V2 is equal to V. Okay, so that's this term, and these two Vs are the same, actually. In addition, I have the kinetic energy of rotation of this pulley. And that's the thing you would have ignored long ago. But now you can't ignore it because it has mass, it has a moment of inertia, so it'll have kinetic energy. So the kinetic energy of this thing is going to be 1/2 I omega squared. When I tell you that it is not slipping, it means that the linear motion of the rope on the edge of that pulley is related to the omega of the pulley. They're exactly related in that the V is equal to R omega at the edge of that pulley. That is, the edge of the pulley has to move with the same linear velocity that the rope goes, otherwise it's slow. So that's equal to R omega, would be the linear velocity of the edge of this thing which is rotating with omega. So I get 1/2 I omega squared, and I can rewrite the I and the omega in terms of velocities. The moment of inertia of a wheel, as we've already seen, actually this class is 1/2 m r squared. So here's the moment of inertia. I plug it in for this I. I get it right here. So this term is this term where I have the 1/2. I substitute in for the I, which is 1/2 m r squared, and I substitute in for omega, which is going to be V over R0, V squared over R squared for the omega squared. So that is the rotational term translated into the linear variables. These two terms just get added together. I have 1/2 m1 plus n2 times v squared, where I'm assuming, you know, I'm saying that the v's are the same. And then I have the initial, I have the initial potential energy on the other side and the new potential energy on the right hand side. Here you go, it's an expression. You're given all the masses, the height, so you can actually just solve for v. And when you do the algebra here, you end up with this. So it might be nasty, or might not, but there it is. And so you end up with a plus or minus 1/4 meter per second squared. 1/4 meter per second. You might say 1.4 meter per second. You might say, what do you mean plus or minus? Well, I guess that really depends on how you define the sense of rotation. So in this case, if I define, for example, when the left-hand mass is going down is positive, it's going to have a positive 1.4 meters per second going down. Okay? If I define it positive the other way, then it'll have a negative value because it's going down. So you just use your common sense and what you may have defined earlier to get that. Any questions on that? All right, so here's the other way to do it. And this is really just an extrapolation of everything that you've done in the past, except now we have an extra degree of freedom, which is the rotation of the pulley. So that means we have to think of each body in the problem. One mass, the other mass, they move linearly, so F equals ma is the equation that you use for each of them. Each of them will move as if there's some net force on it, and so you use some of the forces is equal to the mass times acceleration of each of those bodies. The new thing is that in addition, you'll have this wheel. And this wheel is going to rotate under the law, the sum of the torques is equal to I times alpha. as these masses go faster and faster, the wheel spins faster and faster. So it has to have an alpha. And that alpha maybe is changing or not. In fact, you might imagine it is a constant alpha because the gravitational force on the two objects isn't changing, which means the torque that we have on the two ropes won't change. So the torque will be constant, but it'll be non-zero, which means this thing is going to be spinning. So here, let's think about it. So for these types of problems, I think it's usually instructive to sort of draw the whole thing at once and think about how it all fits together. So here I've drawn the whole thing together, and the motion that's going to happen when you release it is this mass goes down while this mass goes up. And when this mass goes down and this mass goes up, the wheel rotates clockwise for you. Okay? For simplicity, I'm going to define that as positive motion. So that means when I look at each individual piece, I'm going to define down here as positive y for the mass 2. When mass 2 is going in a positive direction, mass 1 is going to be going up. I will define that as positive when I deal with mass 1. And that means that when I look at the wheel itself, I get these two going in their positive direction when this thing goes clockwise. So I'm going to define that as positive rotation in this sort of way, one-dimensional way of thinking about rotation. That's going to be my positive type of rotation, which means if it rotates the other way, it'll be negative. Okay? So then I can sort of draw three free body diagrams. Mass 1 will have the force of gravity down on it and the tension of the rope up. Mass 2 will have the force of gravity down and the tension of the rope up. But here's the catch. This tension and that tension are no longer equal. If this tension and that tension were the same, if you think about what happens to the wheel, I would have the same force pulling down here as I have over here, and the wheel doesn't rotate at all. So, if I were to ask you, for example, if I hang three masses like this, and this whole thing is accelerating upward, I have a rope, a rope, a rope, and this whole thing is accelerating upward, where does the rope break? Which rope breaks, I should say? This one, or that one? Top, middle, or bottom? What do you think? Total exam on problem. Ask your friends. Which one? Agree on which rope you think is going to break. Top, middle, or bottom? Conversation starts to go to what the parties are this weekend. How many of you think top? Middle? Bottom? Why top? This one has to accelerate all this stuff. This one only has to accelerate this one little mass, right? This is the same thing in that this mass pulling has to accelerate this. It has to get it to rotate and get this thing to move up. So if this is going to fall, this tension has to be bigger than that tension if it's going to rotate that way. Okay? So Always remember, if the problem has a pulling with mass, the tensions are not equal on either side of that pull as the thing moves. Okay? Always, always, always remember that. So when you set up the free body diagrams, you need to distinguish this T from that T. So the free body diagrams here and here, you're very used to doing, but now the T's are different. Then we have to do a free body diagram for the wheel. And you can say, well, it's a little bit complicated because the wheel has mass on it, and it's not actually allowed to drop. So the wheel also must have some other mass holding it there, which I just put as an N here. This is sort of irrelevant for the problem. If you have a pulley sitting there, it's just spinning, you really don't need to worry about that degree of freedom for the thing. So it's not going to go anywhere. So although it's true I can put them here, I know nothing about N, so I mean, that's sort of irrelevant. What's important for the pulley is how does it rotate? And the forces that are on the pulley that will cause it to rotate are the tension here, which is the same as what you have on M1 because it's the same rope on that side, and the tension on the other side, which is the same as the tension that you have on M2 because it's on the right-hand side of the pulley. Okay? And now I want to use, for the linear pieces, I want to use the sum of the forces is equal to the Na, which is for this one, this mass 1 times its acceleration going up is equal to the tension, which is pulling it up, so it's positive, minus M1g, which is a force down, which I've defined to be negative over here. So that's where this equation comes from. Newton's second law for this mass becomes M2a, and a way to think about it is if M1 goes up an inch, M2 goes down an inch, so the accelerations are the same in magnitude. I've defined it actually to be a positive acceleration for this mass and a positive acceleration for that mass if the sense of rotation is the same. Okay? So they, in fact, for this one, I have M2A as positive acceleration going down. So the sum of the forces, M2G, is positive because it's going in the same direction as I've defined positive, minus the tension on this side, which is this T prime. Has a negative sign because it's working against, it's going in the opposite direction. Here we have to do the analog, the rotational analog to the linear Newton's second law. In this case, the rotational thing, which is the sum of the torques, is equal to I alpha. So I times alpha for this wheel is equal to the sum of the torques. In this case, the force is at right angles to the line that joins the axis to the point where the force is applied. There's no weird direction involved in things. So the torque is just that radial distance times the force. So this is going to be R0 times T prime. I give it a positive sign because when T prime is pulling this thing, it wants to make it rotate like that, which is how I've defined positive motion. The other rope wants to make it rotate the other way, so its torque comes in with a minus sign. Okay? Then I have I times alpha. I for a wheel is 1/2 mr squared. Alpha is A, the linear A at that radius, divided by R. So I have this is equal to R0 times T prime minus R0 times T. I then pull this down, one of the R's cancels, so on the left-hand side I get the 1/2 mr0a, on the right-hand side r0t prime minus r0t. Okay? I now have three equations. Let's see, I don't know the tensions, but I now can solve for A. And if I have A, these things are all constant, these forces, so I can then take A and solve for what the velocity of the thing is after it drops a certain amount, because it's a constant acceleration. So when I use those three equations and solve for A, I get this, which you can check in the algebra. You solve for A. Once you have A, you can use a constant acceleration equation. This is b squared is going to be 0 squared plus 2a times the distance it goes. And you can calculate that the velocity of this object, which is the body, is 1.4 meters per second, which is what we got using the other technique. Now, for this particular problem, clearly the energy technique was easier. But you need to be very comfortable doing it either way for these kinds of problems.
Regular M is mass of poles.
Say again?
Plane M is mass of poles.
Yeah. It's the mass of the pulley wheel. Let's suppose that we have a pulley wheel here which can freely rotate, and I tell you that the I is equal to 1/2 times mr squared for this thing, and that this is the little radius r, and in real life it's not oblong, it's actually a real circle, and we have a rope that goes down to a mass M, and the rope rotates the pulley without slipping. So I tell you that I'm marrying the rotational degree of freedom to the linear degree of freedom. And what I would like to know is, when I let this thing go, find the correct expression for the acceleration. Get my masses right. So this one has a little m, and that's a big M. Thank you. time, so we'll just do this at the start of class next time. So think about this, and we'll take a look at the start of class next time. I'll try to post this so you'll have it available if you didn't write it down.
Like last week or 2 weeks ago, you said Kepler's law wasn't going to be on, like in stuff involving Kepler, wasn't going to be on the exam. But